Hello, I'm Pastor John Twitchell of the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene. Going to take a break from our regular podcast this week and give you a chance to listen in on bits and pieces of our Faith Promise Convention for Missions. Special missionary speakers Brian and Linda Heil are joining us, and so glad that you're going to have an opportunity to hear what God is doing around the world through mission work, and particularly mission work in the Church of the Nazarene. I hope you'll be blessed by this series of messages from our Faith Promise Convention here at the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene in Cape Elizabeth, Maine.
Well, good morning. This morning, I'm going to show you a little clip about work and witness. I work in the Caribbean region, as I mentioned last night. I've been a missionary in Papua New Guinea and in Paraguay, but for the last 6 years, we have worked in 23 countries in the Caribbean region. Now, that sounds like a lot, but some of our countries are very, very small. Islands like St. Lucia or St. Vincent, St. Martin, very, very small, Aruba. Some of these have only one, two, or three Nazarene churches on them, but those are very important places where people need the gospel. And many times when you hear about the Caribbean, the only point of reference or point of contact that Americans have is maybe they've been on a cruise and they have put in to some port of call with a cruise ship. But if I can be bold enough to say, if you've only seen the Caribbean from a port of call, you have not seen the Caribbean at all. You have seen an artificial environment that was set up only for your benefit. That's not where anyone lives. That's not how anyone lives. The real Caribbean is a place of need, but it's also a place of excitement, and it's a place where God is doing great things, and that's what I'm going to share here. We host around 50 to 60 work and witness teams every year in the Caribbean, and that's a wonderful thing. We missionaries, and that's one of the stories I'm going to tell you this morning, we love having work and witness teams. Work and witness is one of the lifeblood points of Nazarene missions. We just could not survive. We couldn't grow. We couldn't do the things that we need to do without teams of hands-on people, and we're developing a very collaborative strategy of work and witness in that we always expect the local church to work alongside the visiting teams that come, and so it's never just a handout. It's always a relationship in which you work together, but also what is developing is we are seeing work and witness teams coming from one Caribbean country to another. And I'm going to play this clip for you about a group that went from Barbados to Trinidad. People are coming to know Christ through work and witness. A young man who didn't know the Lord but was had a chance to do something internationally and go on a trip that he thought might be exciting and to do something, and he found Christ. And God does that kind of thing. You know, God uses unexpected situations to bring about His work. As I said, we have always loved hosting work and witness teams in Paraguay, in Papua New Guinea, even now, sometimes I have the chance to host teams in countries like the Dominican Republic. And we love having teams because there's a fellowship that happens there. There's a contact that forms a relationship. You work alongside someone for 10 days and then you correspond and you stay in touch, and it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. I remember the very first team that I ever had a chance to host. It was a team from California, and I was a first-term missionary in Papua New Guinea. And they came to work on our Bible college, and it was a great thing because, you know, my little kids were toddlers, and the team members would just pay attention to them and be aunts and uncles to them, and we would eat dinner together, and my kids would sit on their laps, and you know, my kids missed their grandparents, and these people became grandpa and grandma to my little kids, and we had a wonderful time with them, and it was just a really bonding experience for us. But the great thing that we always loved about the work and witness teams, especially in that tribal country, was taking them out to a bush church for Sunday morning worship, because their worship is quite different than what most Americans are used to. We drove we piled into our truck. I had a Nissan four-wheel drive pickup truck. It was a four-door pickup truck. It was, and I have to tell you that I really, really liked that pickup truck. It was a rugged vehicle, you know, and you could drive on those rough roads. And I remember that Sunday, we even had to drive across a river to get to church, and all the team members were very impressed with the fact that to get to church, we had to you know, cross a river, driving in the water, not on a bridge. We went to this very remote place. It was a grass-roofed church, no electricity. I was the district superintendent of 50 churches, and none of my churches had electric lights. None of them had running water. None of them had pews or chairs. Everyone sat on the ground. Men sat on one side, ladies sat on the other side. Men and women never sit together in that society. And so we sat on the ground. They had straw on the ground of the church, and we sat there, and it was a very long service. Very exciting, though. A lot of emotion, a lot of expression of praise to God. And it was a very positive thing, you know, as we worshiped together with the Papua New Guineans and we shared the message with them, and it was a great experience. We really had a bonding experience with the team. And afterwards, we were shaking hands with everyone. Everyone came up and thanked the team members for coming. And I just felt like this was a good thing that we had done by taking the team to this church on that Sunday. After we had greeted everyone, we all went out and we piled into the pickup truck, and you know, we were crammed in there. My kids were sitting on people's laps, and it was very crowded, but it was a happy environment. We started driving away, and I remember everyone was standing outside of the church waving at us. The whole church came outside. They stood there, and they waved at us as we drove away very slowly. The large church property, just open area, but surrounding that open area where the grass roof church was a coffee garden. All churches there have coffee garden. Coffee is very a good cash crop for Papua New Guineans to grow. It's an export crop, and twice a year they get a harvest, and that brings a little money into the church. It's not a cash economy. Usually when people bring their offerings, they bring it in chickens or in produce. You know, they'll bring things and lay them right in front of the altar. That's when they bring the altar. Everybody marches forward, and they'll put something that they've grown in their garden, or they'll hand the pastor a chicken that's hanging by its feet. And you know, that's how they give their offerings. But twice a year they have coffee, and they'll dry the coffee out and they'll sell it, and that brings a little income for something that the church might need. The thing that all churches there want and always are looking for and trying to save money for is a Coleman lantern, so that they can light that and hang it in the church, and then they can have evening services. We had a coffee garden there, and as we drove toward the edge of the coffee garden, four men stepped out. They'd been hiding in the coffee garden. They'd been hiding in the coffee trees. And they stood out right in front of the truck. I was going very slow, and I stopped. Three of these men had long machetes in their hands. But that's not unusual. Everybody in New Guinea carries a machete. That's how you walk through the jungle. You cut as you go. Cut anything that's grown over the trail, and you keep it cut back. So everybody carries a machete there. But the fourth man had an AR-15 automatic rifle in his hand. It's the kind the police there carry. And he quickly ran to the window where I was driving the car, and he pointed it at me. And he said, you all have to get out of this truck. I'm stealing your truck. And I can remember thinking, oh my, what a time for this to happen. Here I have these wonderful people, this work and witness team with me, And we've just had a wonderful experience of praising God, experiencing this new culture, and it was just such a positive thing. And here, now we're getting robbed. And I thought, this is just the worst time for this to happen. I thought I would take a quick look in the back seat to see how the team was reacting. They're holding my children on their laps, and I looked back, and their mouths were hanging wide open. They had this just look of unbelief on their faces, and I just thought, you know, it doesn't matter if this guy shoots us or not. I think these people might die of a heart attack before this is all over. But I want to tell you that Nazarene missions don't go out, missionaries don't go out from one day to the next. I was telling someone last night as we were talking after the service that we were actually missionary candidates for a period of about 6 to 7 years. It takes a long time to become a Nazarene missionary. There's a lot of hoops to jump through. There's a lot of preparation that you have to have. I went to college, and I I studied a lot of missiology. I studied a lot of cultural anthropology and traditional religions. And I knew that the people of Papua New Guinea are an animistic people, which means they are probably more spiritually oriented than you and I are. They believe that there are spirits everywhere, in the trees, in the sun, the moon, in animals. They believe that there are spiritual forces all around them, and their traditional religion is based on manipulating those spirits to somehow protect themselves from the evil forces that are all around. And even more than that, they have a lot of respect for Christians because they know that our God is powerful. In a place like that where spirituality is so out there in front, there's a lot of encounters with power, and they believe that our God has power, even though this man was not a Christian. I knew that that was his worldview. I knew that that's where he was coming from. And so I said to him, I said, look, as he's pointing a gun at me, I am not a businessman. I'm not here in your country to make money. I'm a missionary. And I'm here because God sent me here. And I need to tell you that this truck does not belong to me. This truck belongs to God. And if you steal this truck, you're not stealing it from me. You're stealing it from God. Well, that didn't wash. He stole our truck, left us standing there in front of all the church people. He drove away. We had to get a bus home. The next morning, I went out for a walk. I went walking. It was my habit. It wasn't just that day. Every morning I went out and I would walk in a trail back behind our house into a village area that was back there. It was open, and I had a dog that would walk with me, and he would follow me around. And I just took a walk, and that was my time of being alone, and that was a time of praying. And I had many, many good times of prayer walking on that jungle trail. But that morning, I was upset. I was talking to God, a psalm of lament. I was saying, Lord, here we had these wonderful people with us from California, and they have sacrificed and they have given, and they had to take a bus home because my truck got stolen from me while they were with me. And I was just complaining to the Lord about how I had been treated and how I had lost that truck, because I really liked that truck. And after I had talked this way for quite some time, I guess I said everything I had to say and complained all I had and grumbled all I had. And finally, I got quiet and just walked along that very, very quiet jungle trail by myself. And there haven't been a lot of times in my life when I can say that God spoke to me, but I think this was one of those times. I didn't hear an audible voice, but a thought came to me so clearly and so out of the blue that I believe it was the Spirit of God speaking to me. And here's what he said. He said, Brian, yesterday you were just trying to talk that guy out of stealing your truck. But what you said to him was true. It is my truck. It's not yours. And your wife and your children that were sitting there are mine as well. You're my possession. You've been bought with a price. And I stopped walking, and I stood there on that trail, and I thought, oh Lord, how could I have not realized that? After all this time, here I am, a missionary for the Church of the Nazarene. I've gone to college, and I've gone to seminary, and I'm an ordained elder, and I'm a district superintendent, and I'm a Bible college professor. And I forgot such an elemental truth, that when I gave my heart to Jesus, everything I have went along with that. All my possessions, everything I own, everything is His. I don't have the right to claim anything as my own anymore. And here I was, complaining to God because I'd lost my truck that I liked so much. And it wasn't mine anyway. Nazarenes like you had gone together to buy that truck for me. Well, I didn't buy it. It was a deputation vehicle. You know, when you give a deputation offering to missionaries like me, we buy things like that. Trucks that we need to get around. Computers, things that we use in the work. And here, generous Nazarenes had bought me a truck, and then I was angry with God because I had lost it, and it was never mine to start with. But really, as Christians, everything we own is like a deputation vehicle because it's all to be used in God's work. Everything we have is to be used in God's work. You have a house? Well, that's a center for missions in your community, in your neighborhood. You have a car? Maybe you should be picking up some kids and bringing them to Sunday school with that car. Do you have nice things? Those things are for God's use. Everything that we have belongs to Him. We are His possession. That's a biblical truth. And I guess I just forgot that for a little while. But you know, this Faith Promise weekend is about that kind of truth. This Faith Promise weekend is about reorienting ourselves, like I needed to be reoriented to why we're here on this planet for the very short time that we are here. You know, we're just passing through here like pilgrims. And God has placed some good things in our hands. He's given us some blessings. And His idea is that we use them to build the kingdom of God. One of the things that that my wife and I have just been struck by, it's been a bit of a culture shock. We lived outside the United States in New Guinea and in Paraguay for 10 years. And then we moved back to the U.S. and we live in Miami for the last 6 years. And the culture shock was how fast-paced our society is here in the United States. It seemed that as busy as we were in the work, you know, I had a lot of jobs. I was the Bible college treasurer. I was a professor. I was a district superintendent with 50 churches. But it seemed like I still had time to sit around and talk in the evening with people. Part of it was we didn't have a television. I think that might have been some of it. But just it just seems that in developing countries, people have more time for people and relationships are more important. When we get here, we found ourselves getting caught up in this fast-paced society that is the United States. And that seems to be the time that we lose our orientation on spiritual things and where God is taking us. And on a weekend like this, I think maybe the purpose of it all is to take a little time and to reorient ourselves to what God would like us to do and what is really important to Him. And what is important to Him is this community. God cares about Cape Elizabeth. God cares about the wealthy people who live all around here, but who have no idea of being able to tell a spiritual reality because they've been blinded by a materialistic, fast-paced society. God cares about those people, and He wants to reach them. He wants to use us to reach them. But He also cares about people who live in Cuba or the Dominican Republic or Haiti, who live in grinding poverty and really are trying just to get food on the table every day. And He wants them also to have a chance to know Jesus and to be set free. You know, we talk a lot about Haiti when I talk about missions because Haiti is the largest country of Nazarene membership outside the United States. Did you know that? We have about 100,000 members in the Church of the Nazarene in that very, very small country. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. The average Haitian earns about $300 a year. Not a month, not a week, a year. They earn about $300. And they live in a lifestyle that we cannot imagine. Every Haitian, if he has a chance, will go somewhere besides Haiti. It doesn't matter if he can get to the Bahamas. It doesn't matter if he can get to the Dominican Republic. It doesn't matter if he can get to Suriname. They'll go somewhere besides where they are because anywhere is better than Haiti. It's more wealthy. There are more job opportunities. In Suriname, they earn about $3,000 a year as an average income. That's not very much, is it? $3,000 a year. My, some of you were in that in a couple of weeks, probably. But for a Haitian to be able to get to that society is like hitting the jackpot. They've made it if they can get to Suriname. If they can get to the Dominican Republic and work in sugarcane fields, earning $1 a day, that's not too bad. That's better than the opportunity they had before. But you know what is amazing and interesting and exciting about these people who live in such grinding poverty? Is wherever they go, they win people to Jesus and they start churches. We have Haitian Nazarene churches all over the Caribbean. One of the most exciting churches that we have on our whole region is a Haitian church in the country of St. Martin. I'm talking about Work and Witness this morning. And we've had a lot of Work and Witness teams that have gone to St. Martin to build a very, very large church building in that place. It's a Haitian church. But you know, the exciting thing about this is it's been, like I said, a collaborative effort. The St. Martin church has not just waited for United States folks to come along and do everything for them and wait for the next team. They have put in every bit as much labor and investment in this thing as the Work and Witness teams have done. And it's a very exciting thing. And they continue to win new people and start new churches and even have a vision for others. Now, they're not by any means wealthy. Most of them are day laborers. They work wherever they can to make a little bit of money. And Haitians in St. Martin earn a whole lot less than anyone else earns, but they earn more than they do in Haiti. But whatever meager resources they have, they put it into building that wonderful church that they have, that they love so much. And it's an inspiration to me. We were having some trouble getting some repairs done in a church in Martinique, another French country in the Caribbean. We had a church that was in some disrepair and was kind of just falling down. A couple of floors, it was a three-floor building, and we couldn't go up to the second or third floor because they were unsafe. So we just used the first floor of the building. And our pastor, our Haitian pastor in St. Martin, heard about that. And we were talking about it as we visited with him. And he said, "Now, wait a minute. You have a fine church building there, but you can't use two floors of it just because it needs some repair?" Well, he said, "Well, we'll go there. We'll go and we'll fix it for them. That's not that hard of a thing. It's not that far from St. Martin to Martinique. We'll get on a boat and we'll go over there and we'll fix that church for them." And I just thought, you know, these people really get it. These people have caught not only a vision for building a great church where they live, but they realize that they have a responsibility for Christians everywhere and for spreading this gospel everywhere. And you know, that's what matters. It's the most important thing that there is. I said last night, you know, as I was in Cuba at that Jesus film showing, and or when I was in Papua New Guinea at those stories I told you about, I said last night, that's why I went into this. Because I want to do something that makes a difference. And that's what God's called me to do, of course. But I want to do something that's going to live on beyond my life. My life is short. I'm realizing that with every passing year a little bit faster. It seems like the years pile up a little faster every year now. I'm going to hit 45 this year, and it just seems like I just started in this. You know, I seems like I just became a missionary, and all of a sudden I'm 15 years down the road into this. But I want to do something that's going to last beyond the few years of my life. And again, sometimes I need reorientation of that. Sometimes I forget. Not too long ago, I was on a furlough, you know, doing like I'm doing right now, speaking in churches. And this was an interesting one because I did a district tour. A district tour for a missionary is not like this. This is a Faith Promise weekend where you're at the same church, maybe three services, four services in a row, something like that, where you really get to know people. A district tour is where you're in a different church every night. And districts try to plan. It's harder to do this nowadays. It's hard to get a church to take you on a Tuesday night or a Thursday night or a Friday night because people don't want to come out to church on a night that's not their regular night. But sometimes we still do that. And I had a district tour of the Arizona district. And I had a service Monday night, Tuesday night, and I started in the southern part of Arizona, and I was working my way up through that very expansive district. Arizona's big, and I would drive many miles, and they had worked it out, so I was working my way north. And part of the Arizona district is the state of Nevada. It's called the Arizona district, but it includes that. And I worked my way across the border on Saturday of that week, and I pulled into Las Vegas. I've never been to Las Vegas in my life, but I spoke in three churches of the Nazarene in the city of Las Vegas. We have Nazarene churches there, which is an interesting mission field, let me tell you. And I pulled into town on Saturday, and I called up the pastor of Las Vegas First Church of the Nazarene, where I was going to speak Sunday morning. And I said, "Hello, I'm Brian Heil. I'm your missionary, and I understand that I'm going to be speaking at your church. Can you give me some directions?" And he says, "Well, you know, our church board got together, and we had a contact, and we decided to do something really fun for you, something very nice. We've put you up in a special place. It's a special hotel." Some of you are laughing. I think you know where this is going. So he gave me directions on where to go, and I drove down the strip on a Saturday afternoon. The neon lights were flashing, and you know, I've seen this on TV, but it's different when you're doing it on your own, and it's live, and the millions of neon lights are flashing, and I was driving past all of the big casinos where this man had directed me where to go. And at that time, I was driving an older car. I was driving probably a more than 10-year-old Chevy Corsica. I'd got it off my dad. And it was a pretty beat-up car. It had a lot of miles on it. I had really used it up as much as probably you should use a car. And I pulled up in front of where he had directed me, which was the MGM Grand Hotel. That's where the hotel that was that they had set me up. It's a pretty famous place, I understand. I'd never heard of it until that time. But I'm not sure it still is, but at that time it was the largest hotel in the world. It has over 5,000 rooms in it. It takes up an entire city block. It is the most enormous thing that you can imagine. I just I didn't know they made a hotel that big. But it was so big because the whole entire bottom floor of the MGM Grand is a casino. Well, I pulled up in front of the MGM Grand. I could see it from far away. I could tell the big sign, MGM Grand, so I knew I was going to the right place, but I pulled up in front of it, and I was sort of pulling my stuff together, and someone opened the door of my car. And I was a little frightened. Was I being robbed? What was happening? But it was a nicely dressed man in a very nice tuxedo. It was valet parking. I didn't realize I had pulled up in front of a valet parking, and in my Chevy Corsica. And I had my dirty old suitcase in the back that I'd been dragging around on the mission field with me. And I pulled it out of the back seat, and I just thought, boy, I hope the door doesn't fall off or anything when he opens it. And he drove away, and I can remember saying, "Take good care of that," after all the other cars that I'm sure that he had parked that day. And I walked into the reception area of the MGM Grand. And I can remember just being so taken aback by this place. It had extremely high ceilings. It was very expansive as you walk into this big reception area with large chandeliers that were elegant. And I can remember there were circular couches where very well-dressed people were sitting around talking, and they had beautiful floral bouquets coming out of the center of them. And it was an elegant place. And have you ever just walked in somewhere and felt completely out of place? Well, that's how I felt. I don't know if it was just paranoia, but I just felt like everyone was looking at me and thinking to themselves, "What's this guy doing here?" And I just thought, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies have arrived. You know, I just walking into the wrong place. But I went over and I said, "You know, do you have a room for me?" And they did. Everything was arranged by the church, and that was all very nice. But I was just taken back by this place. I got my room key, and in the MGM Grand, in order to get to a room, you have to walk to the very center of that bottom floor, which means you have to walk through the big casino that takes up that entire bottom floor. And I can remember walking by, and the first thing I walked by were banks and banks and banks of slot machines. And I can remember slowly walking by, sort of just pulling my dirty suitcase along in my hand, watching these people. And I thought, you know, none of these people are having any fun. No one was smiling. It was not like a game. It was more like serious business. They're just pulling on that thing, and more robotic than anything. And then I got to other games of chance that people were playing. I had walked by where people changed money for chips, and I saw how much the chips were worth. $50 chips, $100 chips, $1,000 chips. They have those. And I could see on some of these tables piles of chips. And I just remember thinking, in front of some of these people was more money than I was going to earn that year. And I just thought, my word, there are some high rollers in this place. I mean to tell you, there are people that will win or lose incredible amounts of money just in the time that I walked through here. And I was so intimidated by that place. I can just remember sort of picking up the pace and heading over to the elevator and getting up to my room. I walked into my room. I didn't turn on the light. Threw my suitcase on the ground, and I sat on the edge of the bed. And I remember feeling a little bit sorry for myself. I sat down, and I thought, you know, who am I? I've been running around in a country that most of these people have never heard of. Nobody knows I'm here except for that pastor. There are some really important people here, people that can, you know, make things happen. You know, if they wanted to finish all of our work and witness teams projects that we have on the Caribbean, all they would have to do is write a check and it would be done. There are some people that can really make things happen. I mean, movers and shakers in this building. And I thought, who am I? And what am I doing here? And I sat there for a few minutes, and this was another time that I really sensed the silent, still voice of the Spirit of God speak to me. Like I say, this doesn't happen all the time. But here's what I believe came to me from God. He said, Brian, don't be fooled by this place. There will be a time in the not very distant future when all of this will be gone. This beautiful, elegant building will be nothing but rubble. It's going to burn. And all that money that's downstairs that you're so impressed with right now, that you think is so important, that's going to be gone too and forgotten. No one will remember that. It will pass away. But in that same not too distant future, you are going to be in heaven. And there will be people with you that you have won to Christ. They'll spend an eternity in the presence of God, in the presence of Christ, because of the way you have invested your life. And I had to just stop and say, Lord, please forgive me for forgetting what really matters in life. Forgive me for thinking for even that few moments that money was what really counted. Because it doesn't. It's going to pass away. And the only thing that's going to really matter, the only thing we'll remember, the only thing that we'll take with us are things that we do that have any eternal significance. Things that we've done for Christ. And you know, that's what we're about here this weekend, Faith Promise. It's about investing in things that last. There are two kinds of investments, those that last and those that don't. And we're talking about an eternal investment here. Putting our prayers, our energy, our money, everything that God has placed in our hands, the things that really aren't ours to start with, and saying, God, you know, by worldly standards, I don't have that much. There are a lot of people in Cape Elizabeth that have a lot more than I do. There are some of those people that could write a check and finish all of our work and witness projects in the Caribbean. I'm not one of them. But I am one person. And you have indeed blessed me. You have given me a whole lot more than those Haitians that earn $300 a year. I have relatively, by world standards, if you look at all of the people of the world, I've got quite a lot. And I would just like to turn a little bit of that back to you as you direct. You know, this isn't simply a decision that we make on our own. It's something that God's Spirit directs us to, right? That's faith promise. It's not simply saying, well, I'm gonna figure this out. It's letting God direct us and letting Him say, you know, everything you have is mine. You turned that all over to me when you gave your life to Christ. But we let Him direct us in responding as He would have us to in a moment like this, in a morning like this. I know this isn't the time that we're doing faith promise pledges or anything like that, but when that time comes around, I would like us to just have a moment of reorientation, thinking about whose it all is in the first place and thinking about what's really important in our lives and letting God give us that nudge in the direction towards eternity so that we can invest in that which really matters and that which really lasts. Let's just pray to that end right now. Can I lead you in a word of prayer? Father in heaven, I thank you for this time that we have together, this weekend that we have together. It's my privilege to be here with these good brothers and sisters. I sense in them that we are one in spirit and that we share the same love for you. And so we are brothers and sisters. I thank you for each one, and I pray that you will just guide us, Lord, not anything manipulative, not anything pressure, but out of a cheerful heart of love, we would respond to what your Holy Spirit would have us to do, investing what you've given us into the sake of the kingdom and that which is eternal. We pray this all in the name of Christ. Amen.
You've been listening to a portion of our missions convention here at the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene. That was mission speaker Brian Heil, and I hope you've been blessed and touched as he shared stories of how God has been working around the world. I want to invite you to pray for our missionaries and pray that God would use them wherever they go, wherever they share the gospel. And remember, of course, that God calls you to be a missionary right where you are to serve Him and to share His good news. Well, thanks for listening. Hope you'll tune in again next week. May God bless you as you serve Him today.